kick for Atleti. Good opportunity to give a shout to a blog, a US fan club of Atletico Madrid called Into the Calderon. Do some really good content for all followers of the Colchoneros. A decent base in the United States as well, following the action on ESPN Plus. Give them a follow at Into the Calderon.
Buenos dias y feliz año nuevo. Welcome to a new edition of Colchonero Chat, our 250th episode, if you can believe that, and our first of 2023. Hope you all have had an exciting start to the new year. I'm Jeremy Barron of Into the Calderon. Three-man show for you today. First up, a frequent guest coming back on the pod, Robbie Dunn of Opta and also of Into the Calderon. Hello, Robbie.
Good evening, Jeremy.
We also have with us on the program today a first-time guest, Sid Lowe from The Guardian and the Spanish Football Podcast. You can also read him in the pages of ESPN and also watch him on occasion on ESPN FC. Hello, Sid.
How are you doing?
Fantastic. We are going to be talking today about the upcoming Copa del Rey Round of 32 clash between Real Oviedo and Atletico de Madrid. That takes place tomorrow night, Wednesday night, in Oviedo, in Asturias, at the Nuevo Carlos Tartiere. This will be the first competitive meeting, you guys, between Oviedo and Atletico in over 20 years, since May 5th, 2002, when both sides were in Segunda. Atletico were on their way back up to La Liga, having been relegated 2 years prior, and that game ended 3-2 to the Colchoneros. Sid, do you have any memories at all of that game? Were you in attendance? Anything at all?
No, I can't claim to remember that specific match. I'm just hurting inside now because you made the point there, very pointedly, that Atletico Madrid were on their way back. And of course, Oviedo were not, and still are not. And it's been a very, very, very long time. And I must admit, I can't remember that game clearly. And I was talking to an Oviedo fan earlier on today, and he was saying it was his first time that Oviedo have played one of Spain's big three. As you say, since that season, which was in the second division. Not entirely true, as it turns out, because Oviedo actually played Real Madrid in the Copa del Rey that year. And I remember saying to Steve McManaman, who was Real Madrid's captain when Real Madrid played Oviedo in the Cup that season, I said, "You mean you're going to be walking out as captain at the Carlos Tartiere? I mean, that is every boy's dream, surely." I don't think Steve was quite as keen on it as I was, but I thought it was a dream anyway.
Now, Sid, didn't just hint at it, you actually said it outright. You have a massive love for Real Oviedo. You are a massive Oviedo fan. For our listeners who may not know or may not be aware, and I'm sure you have been asked to tell this story numerous times over the years, but if I could trouble you for it one more time, talk to me about your love for Oviedo. What the city, what the club, what just Oviedo in a general sense, what it means to you.
Well, I mean, in terms of being an Oviedo fan, in a way, it's really just kind of geographical chance. So I did my year abroad as a student because I was doing Spanish and history at Sheffield University in the UK. I did my year abroad in Oviedo, 96-97, which I can't believe I've just admitted because it tells you just how old I am. But anyway, my year abroad at university was 96-97 in Oviedo. At the time, Oviedo were a first division team. To try and put this into context for you, Oviedo's manager was Juan Malillo, who of course has recently just left Manchester City, where he was assistant manager to Pep Guardiola. And that is actually in Oviedo, at the old Carlos Tartiere, not the ground that Atletico and Oviedo will be playing in, was the day that Juan Malillo met Pep Guardiola. Barcelona were ran out winners, I think 4-2 against Real Oviedo that day. But Oviedo played really, really nice football. And at the end of the game, there was literally a knock on the door of the dressing room, the Oviedo dressing room. Someone calls over Juan Melillo and says, "Pep Guardiola, who was playing for Barcelona back then, not the manager, of course, in the middle of midfield, would like to talk to you." And Guardiola basically says, "Your team plays great football. You know, can we just have a chat?" Because that was kind of the nature of Guardiola and very much the nature of Juan Melillo, who I last saw very recently, actually, because he's coaching in Qatar at the World Cup. I went to see him there, him and Santi Cazorla in the same team. So for me, it was like this kind of Oviedo overload. And so that was the year I spent in Oviedo. That was the year when Brazilian Ronaldo was Barcelona. Just the most amazing thing I think I've ever seen in football. And I went to Oviedo, and me and a mate of mine, a guy called Chris from Sheffield University, watching Oviedo play. And we kind of turned up. And I remember we turned up on the day that Oviedo were playing Real Madrid. And we're on the bus from Bilbao Airport to Oviedo, listening on the radio as Oviedo were playing Real Madrid. And this was, I don't know when it was, start of the university term, so it would have been probably early October. And we were thinking, oh, that's pretty shitty luck, isn't it? You know, we turn up in frankly, a pretty small town in Spain that we don't know very much about. And we've already missed the visit of Real Madrid. Anyway, that Monday, we got out a copy of Marca and had a look at the league table and the fixtures so far. We go, wait a minute, we've already missed Madrid. We've already missed Barcelona. We've already missed Athletic. Right? In terms of, it was as if someone was deliberately taking the piss out of us. You know, you turn up at, frankly, again, a small town, a not particularly great club, and you've missed the three most historic clubs, certainly in terms of always being in the first division in Spanish football history. Although, of course, at that point, Atletico had always been in the first division as well. And we think, this is really terribly bad luck. We won't get season tickets. We won't go to every Oviedo game, but you know, we'll go a little bit. That weekend, Oviedo played, if I remember rightly, Deportivo La Coruña. We went to see the B teams play each other on the Saturday, the first teams play each other on the Sunday, and then didn't miss a game for the rest of the season, except for one that I missed in hospital because I broke my ankle playing football in Oviedo in Regional, which is, I don't know even what tier to call that. It's a long way down anyway. So missed a couple of games, but didn't miss the derby that year, which I went to in a wheelchair. Went to the Oviedo Sporting King on derby in a wheelchair. But that year, and apologies for saying this, but I'm going to, the best performance of the season by a very, very long way was a Saturday night at the old Carlos Tartiere when Oviedo beat Atletico Madrid 4-1. And of course, that was the Atletico double winning team.
Yeah.
Sid, you just mentioned there about Juan Malillo, and I wanted to ask you about that because on Twitter, I mentioned it all the time, that article, the brain in Spain. And I hope actually that meeting in Qatar was maybe planning the brain in Spain part two. But
I wish I was. I actually said to Juanma, you know, if you want to do an interview, and he's a bit bored of the media now. And that includes me, by the way, despite being a mate of mine.
But I just wanted to ask you about that interview because when I read it, I get the impression it was you knew that he would just keep going, and it was kind of like that infinite regress, and you were like, but why? And I could read the kind of cheat, your kind of the impishness, and your kind of, were you going for that approach when you were asking him? And he kept saying, but Sid, this is why. And you were like, yeah, but why would that be the case? And were you going for that effect?
Not deliberately. I mean, obviously, I knew Juanma because I'd worked with him. I'd done TV work with him during the 2006 World Cup in Spain. And we got on very well. And we partly got on very well because I'd said to him the first day I met him, so, bloody hell, you're my manager. You know, you're the guy that managed my team the first time I ever saw them, the first year I ever lived in Spain. And he's incredibly intellectually challenging, Juan Malillo, and he doesn't accept the cliches. And everything you say, he's challenging you on it. And so when I went to do that interview, it wasn't kind of a deliberate attempt to say, you know, let's kind of have a battle, if you like, a dialectical battle. It was more just like, let's have a conversation. But that's in Juanma's nature. So every time you say, well, what about this? He said, that's just total rubbish. And he's really good at saying that's rubbish. And your assumptions are wrong. And what are you basing that on? And the good thing, I suppose, in terms of that, particularly that interview, and it, you know, it wasn't really my intention to kind of go and do an interview in which we showcased anything in particular. I just knew that he was an interesting guy and wanted to talk to him about football. And that's how I proposed it to him. So let's just have a chat about football. And I had a series of ideas of what I wanted to talk about, but I knew that the conversation would go where it went, just because it does with Juanma, and you don't know where that's going to be, but you know it will be somewhere, right? But what made it good, I suppose, from my point of view at least, was because I knew him well enough, and we got on well enough, I felt that I could go back at him. Whereas I think quite often when you do an interview with someone, particularly someone who's, you know, been successful in the game, who's got a name for themselves and so on, when they challenge you, there is a temptation. Maybe temptation is not even the right word. There is an inclination, I suppose, to kind of back off a little bit and say, all right, look, this is a guy who's been in football for years, right? I don't know shit compared to this guy. And I would still admit that I don't know shit compared to this guy. But there is a bit of you that sort of backs away a little bit. But because it was Juanma, I could say, yeah, but what about? And what about? And what about? To which, of course, he would say, no, because of this, this, and this. And it just, I mean, just basically talking to Juanma is great fun. But there's a lovely bit in that interview And do you know what? I can't actually remember for sure if it went in its entirety. I know there was definitely a mention of it, where he basically made the point that the joy is in the process and not in the end result. And he basically said to me something like, you know, so for example, you do this interview. For this interview to be good, you've got to go and care for it. So you've got to go and take it home. You've got to transcribe it. You've got to give it shape. You've got to make it worthwhile. You've got to put it in a magazine that hopefully will give you the space that you feel allows it to breathe. You've got to go and care for this now. It's not just you turning up here and having this conversation. And I thought, wow, at last someone understands that the interview isn't just turning up and having a chat. Because, and actually, of course, what the point he was making was that you will not treat this interview any better because you're better paid or less well paid than for an interview with another publication that maybe pays you more. But what will actually drive you through it, or what will carry you through it, or what will make you feel like it's worthwhile, is the feeling of its intrinsic value. And I remember having that. I'm obviously not going to name the magazine for very, very, very obvious reasons, but I remember doing a piece for a magazine that paid massively over the odds for it because it was a kind of commercial business style thing. And I wrote this piece about Zidane for them. And I wrote what I thought was quite a nice piece. But I promise you, I didn't try any harder because they were paying me four times as much as anyone else was. Because actually what carries you through is sort of the joy of the thing itself. And when you write something about a conversation with Juan Malillo, then of course there's a joy there.
Yeah, yeah. And just on that, the and it's funny because you are someone who just absolutely loves football. I remember just an anecdote from me and Brendy Boyle, one of the lads, was at an Alcorcon game. It must have been about 7 years ago.
Are you suggesting that I went to Alcorcon? I don't believe you.
But like, you know, Sid goes to all these games, and it's kind of like a trope, like almost at this stage, where it's like, oh, Sid, like a joke, like, oh, Sid's at all these games, like, you know. But we were at this Alcorcon game against, I think it was Reus. And yeah, it was.
Oh, is that the one I was at when I was the only away fan?
Yeah, and me and Brendy were sitting, and like, there was one person sitting in the Alcorcon away end. And I think you had your son with you. And
yeah, there were two of us. Yeah.
And I was looking, and Brendy was like, I think that's Sid Lowe. And I was looking, I was like, oh my God, What a freaky, as they say in Spain. But like, I text Sid, I said, are you at the Alcorcon game? And you're like, yeah, that's me. And I was just like, that's someone who just absolutely loves it. But yeah, that's it.
I will admit to that one being a slight cheat, because playing up front for Rose that day was a guy called Miguel Linares, who had been Oviedo's top scorer when they came up from Seville Navy. And that's so right. We were there very much as Linares fans. In fact, in my son's wardrobe downstairs is Linares' shirt from that very game.
Nice.
It was well worth it. I mean, but yes, it is true that I would probably go to an Alcorcon Reus game anyway.
Ah, that's lovely. After all these years, that you still love it. That's amazing.
After all the years and all the distance traveled and all the games attended, you still have that hunger for it.
Yeah, I mean, look, like anything, it is true that when it's a job and it becomes an obligation, there are times, of course, when it loses some of the magic and some of the joy. But the bottom line is, it's still football, and I do still quite like football. And I've thought this occasionally with you know, sometimes you get in discussions with people, and you sometimes think, yeah, but you're sort of missing the point. And the point is, I quite like this. the point is, this is quite good fun. Now, obviously, it's not always, and as you say, Robbie, there is a sort of a degree of it being a bit of a trope now, this kind of, what the hell are you doing at Getafe? But once in a while, you get an unexpected partidazo, and so it's worth it.
Now, Sid, Oviedo have not been in La Liga since 2001, which I know is immensely disheartening to you. But they have been established in the second tier since 2015, so about 8 years now. Talk to me and talk to us in general terms and brushstrokes, just how this season has gone for Oviedo.
Well, this season's a slightly strange one, because last season Oviedo missed out on the playoffs on goal difference.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've seen it, but there's... I mean, I laugh about it now, and I tried to laugh about it at the time, but it was genuinely quite painful that Oviedo on the last league game of the season, they got word of a goal in the other game which would have put them in the playoffs, and we went absolutely mad, and the players went mad as well. And then someone said, hang on, there hasn't been another goal. And we looked like total morons celebrating this goal that hadn't happened. Anyway, so you get the situation in which Oviedo had a really good back end of last year. Maybe not always the greatest team to watch, but getting good results, went on a really good run. I still think, to be honest, it's unforgivable that there was a game I think it was Zaragoza, and we thought that a draw was quite good. And at that point, saying it's not good because we've got to go to Las Palmas and win, and we went to Las Palmas and got beaten. Anyway, that's to cut a long story short. We got to the end of last season thinking this was a pretty strong team, and then a new manager came in who, of course, was John Pérez Bolo, who'd done a really, really good job last year with Ponferradina, wasn't it? I think it was Ponferradina, and there was a kind of sense that this will sort of open the team up a bit, and it will take us that extra little step. And for reasons that I've not been able to fully put my finger on, and I've asked friends who watch Oviedo as fans, and I've asked friends who watch Oviedo as journalists covering Oviedo, what the hell happened? And it just feels like there was no connection with the players from the very start. And so Oviedo started the season absolutely abysmally. And it really was a shock because, you know, we felt there was a good enough team. They persuaded Borja Bastón to stay. They persuaded Borja Sanchez to stay. Two really, really good players at second division level. Like, really good players at second division level. And you look through the squad, and all right, it's true that Brugman had left, who I thought was a player that Oviedo could ill afford to lose, but defensively really strong. And the quality of the players in the team made me think this should be a good team. And they were just bloody awful. And then you get Álvaro Cervera take over. Now, for those who don't know, of course, Cervera was the guy that brought Cádiz up from Segunda B to Segunda and into Primera. And I think by the end of his time at Cádiz, it had actually become a bit of a self-parody because he embraced so much this idea of, and forgive me for saying this, but I'm going to say it given the podcast we're on, of Cholismo. You know, we'll be like Cholo Simeone, we'll be very defensive, we'll be very strong. I don't care if it's 0-0, I don't want possession, I don't want the ball. And by the end, to be honest, I think he was taunting Cádiz and trying to basically get them to sack him. And he became this self-parody and this kind of sense of it all going a little bit bitter at the end. It was a real pity because he'd done such an incredible job for Cádiz. It was extraordinary what he'd achieved there. Admittedly, not always the greatest team to watch. And he joined Oviedo. And I'll be honest with you, I was one of those people that wasn't entirely sure about this. And I wasn't entirely sure because, as you've mentioned, when you talk about the amount of time, you know, 2015 in the second division, went down in 2001. I was actually there when Oviedo went down from the first division in Mallorca. We got beaten in Mallorca and went down on the final day of the season. And none of us really thought we'd be there that long, let alone that we'd end up going all the way down to Tercera, into Segunda B, into Segunda, and never quite getting into the first division. But there was a bit of me that when Álvaro Cervera came in, I kind of thought, you know what, I'd quite like us to have a manager who, quite apart from the obvious thing, which is we all want to go up, I'd quite like us to be fun to watch. Because for a long time, I've actually not watched a lot of great football at Oviedo, in truth. And I wasn't 100% sure, I must confess, but I was, like all new managers, when they come in, I'm thinking, well, hopefully this is the guy. And the results have been really, really good since. A lot of 1-0s, a lot of very close games, not very exciting, some draws. But the results since he took over, I believe, put Oviedo in fourth or fifth place in the second division, if you made a league table of just results since he took over. Now, I know it doesn't work like that, but it's obviously a sign of a degree of improvement. And Oviedo have become, I suppose, what you'd expect them to become under Cervera, which is very, very tough, quite direct, not that worried about the ball, very, very difficult to break down, and I think have the players to maybe now be a team that you would say could go up. The thing is, of course, there's a lot of ground to make up. So they're a long way from being in a position where they could go up. But as anyone who watches the second division knows, there's often very, very little difference between the team in fifth and the team in 15th.
Yeah.
You know, that gap can be bridged really quite quickly. So things are looking reasonably good from that point of view.
And that tends to happen in the Segunda where a team, and it actually happened to Cervera with Cádiz. They were the standout team
absolutely
for 3 or 4 years.
Yep.
And then there was like an 8-game spell at the end where, and especially that counter-attacking football that he plays with the wingers, he got a couple of hamstring injuries here and there, Salvi Sanchez and guys like this. And all of a sudden, the standout team in the Segunda that year ends up just sixth or fifth, and they end up, the playoffs is just a nightmare, like it's a lottery almost. So I think that's something.
Well, I mean, I remember, you know, obviously seeing this from an Oviedo perspective. I remember seeing Osasuna at Oviedo sometime in early spring, so maybe February, March time, something like that. And the feeling being that Osasuna are in trouble. You know, there's a bit of a crisis brewing, that things aren't looking good, and they beat Oviedo and went up. How the hell did that happen? And you look at Las Palmas last year. There was a period of the season last year where Las Palmas didn't look like they were going to be a great team. And all right, they didn't go up in the end, but they got themselves into the playoffs. And by the end of the season, you're looking at them thinking they're probably the best team in the division. Taking away Levante, who, of course, you know, more or less ran away with it. And that happens an awful lot in the second division. And, of course, that's the hope we cling to. Now, I try very hard not to get too hopeful. because it does feel like Oviedo's natural place over the last 7 or 8 years has basically always been two places and 2 points away from the playoffs. Always just about within touching distance, but not really. Always going into the last 2 or 3 weeks of the season thinking, well, mathematically it could happen, but realistically we don't think it will. I remember being at the last game of the season away at Elche, and it must be about 4 years ago now. I've lost track of time. Genuinely, in Elche's ground, which is a big ground, there must have been no more than 600 or 700 people. Like, the place was almost empty. And I'm thinking, but Oviedo could go up today. And Oviedo fans, not even very many of them. But of course, we all deep down knew that they couldn't. And there's a little period in the second half when the results coming from the other games, oh, maybe. But deep down, you know, it's not going to happen. And so Oviedo being 8 and a couple of points off the playoff kind of feels like our natural place. And I really hope that we break that. Although last year, say, we broke that. But it was even more heartbreaking because it was 7th and goal difference away from playoffs.
Mm.
And I think we'll talk about Atletico now, Sid, but I just wanted to, I think you kind of undersold your kind of connection with the club, because a couple of years ago before the pandemic, I went up to Burgos to interview Michu, and your name was mentioned. I don't know whether it was you it was him that mentioned you or me, but your name came up anyway. And Michu genuinely, he looked at me, Sid's a legend. And I was like, oh yeah. And I was looking, I obviously knew that you had a really strong connection to Oviedo, but it was then that it really hit home that Sid Law is part of Real Oviedo. And like, even you kicked off one of their games. So could you kind of explain just how deep it goes?
Michu is a total legend. I love Michu. And one of the nice things actually about supporting a team that's not a big deal is how close you kind of become to them. And particularly, you know, I'll say this from the point of view of my son. I mean, my son, obviously he knows that Messi's the best player in the world and Diego Ferreira isn't. But as far as he's concerned, Diego Ferreira is the best player in the world and Michu's the best player in the world. And you know, Saul Berchon is the best player in the world and Borja Sanchez is, you know. But the one of the nice things is that kind of closeness and sort of that sense of really being part of it. But in this particular case, I think it comes from in 2012 it's 2012 because it was 10 years this year. Christ, time goes. Anyway, 2012, obviously, we're close to going out of business, and the board of directors at the time, which was really just a group of fans, decided basically on one last dramatic roll of the dice, which was, right, there's one way of rescuing this, and they did a share issue. And essentially what happened was that there was a push to try and get people to buy shares to try and rescue Oviedo. They needed, I think, 1.9 million euros within 2 weeks. I think it was 3.9 million euros to basically have a future, whereas the 1.9 would be just enough to get to the end of the season. And they needed some way of pulling themselves out of a huge financial and institutional crisis. And the last shake of the dice was to go for a share issue. And to be perfectly honest, what I did was really quite minor, but it's been treated in Oviedo like I did something amazing, and it's actually deeply embarrassing in some ways, and I often feel that, you know, so many people who worked really hard on this and did so much more than me. But essentially what I did in that period was to push this idea of share issue, to basically go on Twitter and be a pain in the ass and tell everyone to buy shares and push people to buy shares and force it through and say, come on, buy shares in this club that gave you Santi Cazorla and gave you Michu and gave you Juan Mata, who were all playing in the Premier League at the time. Go on, don't let this club go out of business. And amazingly, people responded. And so from all around the world, people bought shares. And so there is this, I suppose you could call it in Oviedo, this kind of sense that I played a part in sort of rescuing the club, I guess, which is a ridiculously overblown way of putting it, but it's how people have treated me, and it's just completely lovely and completely over the top, and people are really, really brilliant with me. And as you say, one of the things that happened was that 1 year, will be 2000, which year is it? Oh, honestly, I can't remember now. I did the pregón, which is essentially the opening speech, I suppose, that start the city's fiestas. And then that weekend, I was invited to do the honorary kickoff at a Real Oviedo game. By the way, at a Real Oviedo game against Cadiz, whose manager was Álvaro Cervera. I've not met him since he took over at a Real Oviedo. One day, I hope to be able to tell him that.
You mentioned Borja Bastón a moment or two ago, Sid, and Robbie, this will just underscore how long we've been doing this. There is an Atleti Oviedo connection in this game. It is through Borja Bastón, and in the early days of Insta Calderon, the early days of Colchonero chat, there was this debate because he had such a good year at Eibar on loan in 2015-16. You know, should he come back to Atletico? Should he be given a chance under Diego Simeone in the first team? Robbie, I know you remember these conversations and the debates on the pages of Into the Calderon very well, but Sid, how important has Borja Bastón been these past two seasons? Wow. I mean, 30 goals and 61 league appearances, 22 last year, 8 this year. He'll take some stopping.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, he's at Oviedo, he's been a relatively kind of straightforward striker, right? So a number 9. This isn't a guy that's going to do really amazing things with the ball. He's not a guy that necessarily is going to create something out of nothing, but he has an awareness, he has a sharpness, his finishing is brilliant. He has what appears to be a commitment to, what's the word I'm looking for? A commitment to the team, to the approach, to playing the game that's really striking. Because this is a guy, I think, that you could look at and say, actually, he should be playing in the first division. And in the summer, certainly, I think we all thought he would leave, and he hasn't. And I think there's clearly a sense that he's found himself there. Now, I'm not going to overplay this because I'm not so naive as to say, you know, he loves Oviedo. I'm sure he does, actually. But, you know, I'm not going to be so naive as to assume that he will never leave. But I think there was a sense of a connection with him. There is a slight sense amongst Oviedo fans, I think, that we... I wouldn't necessarily include myself in this, by the way, but the kind of the Oviedo identity is we like a no-nonsense footballer. You know, we like a footballer who's going to kick you if he has to, who's going to get in the area and stick his head in where he shouldn't, who's going to you know, bundle the ball over the line. And this speaks a little bit to Diego Ferreiro, who was our grand, you know, that's very Spanglish, our great icon. You know, he was because he was at Oviedo in Segunda B, because he was at Oviedo as this kind of big lump of a forward, but scored bloody loads of goals and was completely committed and is an Oviedo fan, as in from the city. Now, obviously, these things don't all apply to Borja Bastón, but I think we could see a bit of that in him. You know, we could see that sense of connection, this kind of committed, tough, no-nonsense forward. And he, you know, everybody absolutely loves him, and he has been massively important in a team. You know, I go back to this, and this was true last season. With Cuco Ziganda, and I think it's been true now with Álvaro Ferreira. I think it was even true at the start of the season when the team weren't playing very well. The few goals that were being scored were being scored by him. He's a guy that's, if you like, whose clinical nature, the fact that he doesn't take many chances for him to score is really important for a team that doesn't create that many chances. Admittedly, there's quite a lot of penalties among his goals. And if you look at our stats this year, we really haven't scored very many goals, and a very high proportion of them are penalties. I think Borja has got 8 in La Liga, and I think maybe 4 are penalties. But he is a guy that you just feel you can rely on. And he's massively, massively important for Oviedo. And I hope he stays to the end of the season. I hope that staying to the end of the season sees Oviedo go up. I mean, obviously, I hope that for myself, but I hope it for him as well. And that for him, it feels like he's kind of either able to leave Oviedo having fulfilled his task, or able to stay at Oviedo and be a first division player.
He has scored quite a few penalties, as you mentioned, Sid.
Yeah, it is a lot of penalties.
8 from 11 attempts last year, that strikes me as a lot. And 4 from 5 this year. So for Atletico, just don't let him get to the spot. Just don't let him attempt the spot kick.
Yeah, or alternatively, please do. As many times as you possibly can.
You might be hoping for that. Yeah. He will be going up tomorrow against an Atletico defense that will not have Stefan Savage. He's out due to some physical discomfort. Rodrigo de Paul and Joao Felix will not play either, and I do want to talk to you both about Joao in just a moment. Sid, I'm curious about this, the difference between the two Carlos Tartieri stadia. Have you noticed any difference between the old one and the new one?
Oh, yeah, massive, yeah. But I think part of it is emotional as opposed to real. So obviously there's that sense of emotional attachment of having lost the old Carlos Tartieri, which was a little bit close to the city centre, but really not by much, by the way. You know, you can walk, there's a hotel now and a shopping centre, which is actually just closed. It was a complete disaster opening that shopping centre, total failure. But it's got a conference centre and some of the governmental bodies are in there. And as I say, there was a shopping centre which is gone. There's a very sort of stylish hotel in a Calatrava building, which is actually a bit of a monstrosity. But that's on the site of the old stadium. And you can walk from there to the new stadium in less than 10 minutes. So it really isn't a big move. But the new stadium kind of didn't feel as tight to the pitch. It doesn't feel as close. But actually, I think objectively, it's probably a better stadium. It's certainly a bigger stadium. And it's an unusual shape, which I quite like. It's square, which football stadiums normally aren't, you know, hard-edged square stadium. It has a bit of a microclimate of its own. It's down in a ditch, and it feels like it's colder than everywhere else. You know, you can go around Oviedo and it'd be a bit chilly. Go into the ground, it's freezing cold. The wind sort of comes off the hillside and kind of seems to go right through it. It's a bit concrete. It's been given character, actually, by the fact that it's been painted all over by the fans. There's really nice murals all over it now. And I worry that at some point there will be a facelift done, and they'll try and make it modern, they'll try and make it smart, and they'll get rid of that. But actually, that's what gives it its character. I think it's a good stadium. I would argue that this isn't the case tomorrow, because tomorrow it's been sold out. So there will be 28,000, 29,000 in there tomorrow. I would argue it's actually a bit too big for us as a second division team, because Oviedo are most weeks getting 14,000, maybe 15,000, which actually in the old type, they would have felt, it's full and it's noisy and it's close to the pitch, and this is a big second division club. In truth, in a stadium that big, it can feel a little bit empty, because, of course, what happens is people go to their seats. And so the bits you see on TV or people are not packed in together. I personally would be in favour of saying, let's close the upper ring and force everyone down and force everyone together to try and create atmosphere. But it's a good second division stadium. It's possibly the biggest in the second division in terms of capacity. I don't know if Molinón or the Romareda or the Rosaleda might be as big. Las Palmas' new ground, which is very smart but a little bit soulless because it's a bit too new for my liking. They might be as big. But it's objectively a good ground, but I think people miss the old one. That said, bear in mind that it's 22 years now.
Yeah.
So people might well miss the old one, but actually we're a dying breed, those of us who remember it.
Robbie, how do we think Atletico are going to approach this game at the new Tagliatti on Wednesday? I had the feeling, as you've written about on our site last week, I have a feeling a certain Pablo Barrios might have a say in how this game goes. One of the most exciting prospects to come out of Atletico's system in quite a few years.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, in terms of... Simeone has kind of been forced to play him now with Rodrigo de Paul out, and given the fact that it just coming back into the starting off the new season, the Copa del Rey was a good chance for Barrios. But I don't know when the chips are down if he's going to continue to have faith in him. Like, I mean, Simeone is one of the criticisms I would have had, is that he doesn't bring players through. So, but at the same time, Barrios was exceptional when he did play. And he's kind of forced Simeone to at least consider him now over De Paul. But again, I'm not entirely sure, given the fact that, as Sid has said, their Real Oviedo play a specific style. I just think Simeone completely understands how Cervera plays, so I think he's not going to be getting mugged by him, by his own style, basically. It's been a bit crazy with the way that the Atletico played recently in that, and with the World Cup guys coming back. Mario Hermoso has played. I mean, a lad who just looks like he's completely lost his head. The answer is I don't know.
I must admit, I really like the look of Barrios, and I would like to think they'll get the continuity, because one of the things that's really stood out for me is actually that attitude that says, I'm not scared of this. I'm not frightened by this at all. Now, obviously, that's not a guarantee of anything, because young players, you know, it's not always a linear progression, but the early signs are very, very good with him. I mean, look, although Rodrigo de Paul hasn't been that great for Atletico, I thought he was really good for the first 4 months or so, and he's starting to think, there's a really good player here, but it hasn't really happened. But we are still talking about a World Cup winner. We are still talking about a player who can really play. So I wonder what the role for Barrios will be. But I would expect him to play this game, and the early signs are very, very good indeed. And I just wonder if maybe with Simeone, it's an opportunity for him to play him now when it might not have been before, because given the problems they've got, it's almost easier to be brave, if you see what I mean. And it's easier to use a kid from the youth system as, if you like, a lessening commitment to the others. Now, it's a bit cliche and it's a bit obvious, but at the moment, I think it's a kind of lesson that could be valuable to Simeone, because I think he knows that he's got a lot of players who from his point of view at least, and again, to fall back onto the cliche, he maybe doesn't see the degree of commitment from them that he would like to see from them.
Sid, I actually wanted to ask you that about Simeone. You're someone who I've noticed, I don't know if this is something that you do, but do it on purpose, but you see, you always sit right up the front of the press conferences to make sure that you're kind of getting everything, and you're someone who asks, sometimes the press conference, the questions can be a little bit kind of silly, and you've spoken on TSFP about some of the Spanish media being a little bit kind of driven by the sensational stuff, whereas you kind of try to dig in a little bit deeper. And Simeone is someone who I know is at press conferences, and I want to know, you have seen a whole lot more of him than I would have had, both live at games and in press conferences and even in mix zones and stuff like that. I get the sense that Simeone, I can't square it. Who is he? What's the authentic Diego Simeone? Because there's this kind of grabbing himself by the huevos and all this kind of crack and running down the tunnel after a game, and like uncontrollable. But then he goes into the press conference and he seems like he never gets worked up about anything. And that's good. It's really, really good in a way, because nothing seems to faze him. But at the same time, come on, man. You have to at least show something has to bother you, or is it all just a big performance? Yeah. Because another thing is that I've noticed, and I know this is kind of a silly thing and that, but like, not one of the other top coaches are on advertisements here, and Simeone's on Orange. Yeah, and I'm like, yeah. Here's this guy who's this, like, he's like the working class and guy, and he's all about hard work. And I just I don't know. There's different bits of the Simeone thing that I'm not really understanding. Have you thought about that?
I mean, given that you posed this question, Robbie, through the point of view of dealing with the press, I think there's something that I've noticed, I think, that I hadn't noticed before, which is, let me kind of put this in context for you. ESPN got the rights for La Liga just over a year ago, and I've started doing pitch side for them, which basically means I also do the flash interview. Now, for those who don't know, the flash interview is the immediate post-game interview, and what will normally happen in a flash interview is you've got what's known as a super flash, which is the local broadcast of Spanish TV, and that's normally just a player pitch side. But the flash interview will be the rights holders, so you know, normally down in the flash area, which is literally just at the top of the tunnel at the Metropolitan. So you players come up the tunnel, and there's, like, I suppose you'd call it a foyer, and in that foyer bit, sort of an open space, is where the TVs are set up with, you know, as you'll recognise this on the TV, with the advertising boardings behind, and a manager comes over and talks. And so ESPN will be there, Spanish TV, so normally Movistar will be there. There's Danish TV, the La Liga TV, there's usually a couple of other international channels. There might be five or six TV channels there. And Simeone will give 2 or 3 minutes to normally 3 or 4 of the 5 or 6. And one of the things that I've noticed from doing that, whereas before, as you say, it would be press conferences, which is for written journalists, which he goes to after he's spoken in the flash, is how often I have felt, speaking to Simeone in those instances where you've got 3 or 4 questions and you've got the press officer hovering on your shoulder. And by the way, I've discovered that I'm not as good at asking questions in that scenario as I am in a press conference, where I feel less kind of preyed upon, and where I feel that I don't need to ask that obvious question, first question, which is just, you know, what are your thoughts on the game, which is always the first question, or words to that effect. Anyway, what I've noticed in that is I feel much more like he's reading from a script than I used to, because I'll hear what he says to me and then I'll hear him go to La Liga TV and say the same thing. And I will notice in that context much more that no matter what I ask, he's got his answer. It almost doesn't matter how I phrase it, he's got his answer. Certainly on the first question. And he will make that first answer quite long. And I don't know if that's deliberate, to try and give me less time to ask the other things. Whereas in a press conference, of course, there's been 5 or 6 questions before me, so I can then go off on somewhere else, and maybe he's less prepared to kind of pull it back because he's already said those other things. And one of the other things to point out is that Simeone, like a lot of managers, but not all of them, has his own press guy. That's not to do with the club, who looks after him, who looks after his image, who I'm sure will be guiding him through some of these questions, who will be guiding him through some of the things that he might get asked. And I think there is a conscious sense of a public image there, which, as you say, doesn't always tally with the one we see on the touchline. And I think that's very interesting. I think that tells you something about control. It tells you something about an awareness of the significance of how he's seen. And I would argue, but again, this is interpretive rather than informative, me saying this, that that is about understanding, if you like, the political dynamics as well as the sporting dynamics. That's about understanding how people receive him as much as how he sends a message, if you see what I mean. And I think he's a very, very bright man. I mean, well, that stands, you know, that's obvious given everything he's achieved over the last 10 years. But I think he's an aware man of how his words can be twisted. I think he's aware of how the media can respond to him. I also think that while I'm not party to this personally, I am very well aware of it, that those journalists who follow him everywhere, who go to all of the away games, he knows who all of them are. He knows how they react to things that he says. He knows who is receiving his message as well as what he's saying. And I think that's part of what you're talking about, Robbie. I think that idea of what does this, how does this get consumed? Not just what do I say, but how does this get consumed? And I think he's very, very well aware of that. I also think he knows, because he's not stupid, because he's been there for a very long time, that a football club is not a single voice. For a very long time, he has been the dominant voice of Atletico Madrid, but he's not the only one. And he's certainly not the only one in terms of, if you like, the unpublished stuff that gets said. And I think he knows that. I think as well that he is a manager who knows that he's in a difficult situation, and he embraces that and he admits it. But I don't think he necessarily wants to give too much of it away when he talks about it. And I think one of the reasons why he talks a lot about passion and so on, at least did to start with, was because he saw that as the way out. But I think if you listen to him over the last 3 or 4 years, I think he gives you much more tactical insight than he once did. I think he's much more prepared to talk about structures, to talk about what players give him, to talk about what he's trying to achieve. And I actually think that if you go down those routes, he gives you really interesting answers. I think he's got really interesting things to say.
And this is, in a sense, Sid, mirrored how Atletico tried to evolve in recent years.
Absolutely.
Certainly during the title-winning season in 2020-2021. Last year, it was, as Robbie and I talked about, it was just a bit of a mess, and Atletico ended up finishing a distant third. And this year, we've seen Atletico, as has been the case over the years, kind of caught between two eras. And Sid, I know you've talked about this before, Robbie. I know you've talked about this before. And Sid, you did a bit of a deep dive on this for ESPN a few days ago in your column about Joao Felix, which touched on his relationship with Simeone and his situation at the club, and the idea that Joao is kind of the right player, but in the wrong place at the wrong time. Talk to us a little bit about what you mean by that and where you see the situation.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that I said in that piece, which is, I don't know if this is the most important, in fact, it's definitely not the most important part of it, but I think it's an important maybe starting point, because we have to contextualize everything. And obviously the contextualization of this is a guy who's played 26 senior games when he joins Atletico Madrid. I think it's 26. I can't remember the exact stat. It might be fractionally more than that, but it's not many. Who comes for 126 million euros? Who comes under the arm of an agent who has an extremely close relationship with Atletico Madrid? Who effectively promises Atletico Madrid, this guy will always have a sell-on value. You know, I will see to it that when he goes, if he has to go, that you don't lose out on this. So take this risk now, because it's not really a risk, because I'm guaranteeing his future, which you can never guarantee, because you can never know how good a player is going to turn out to be. Although, of course, you're talking about an agent who's just got you 40 million euros for Cunha. And so, you know, even if it doesn't come from João Felix, there's a degree of complicity, there's a degree there. But of course, what happens is, that's, if you like, an institutional side of it. But then, of course, it's down to the player and the manager and the teammates to make this work. And the point I was moving on to was that moment when Gil Marín says at the start of December that, you know, there's a problem, and he admits publicly, and I was very struck by this, very, very struck by this, that maybe the solution is this guy has to move on. But he makes a point of saying the relationship between the manager and the player isn't great. Now, that may well be true. In fact, I think we all know it is true, right? Even if no one else is publicly saying it. That may well be the fundamental point. But I'm always a little bit uneasy when people in a managerial or a directorial role, and obviously Gil Marín is even more than a director. You know, he's essentially the owner of the club. He's not quite, but he's essentially the owner of the club. When someone like that essentially allows two men to carry the responsibility publicly, I'm always a little uneasy about it, because there's a context to this, and it's a context of, why did you buy him? Why did you buy him at the point that you bought him? What did you really think the solution for him was? How much did you do to help resolve some of these internal issues? And I think there are a lot of contextual elements to take into account, not just do Simeone and João like each other. And even if Simeone and João do like each other, in footballing terms, can they really meet in the middle? Because there are different approaches. Now, I would argue that in the season in which Atletico Madrid won the league, for the first 4 or 5 months of the season, that we found a solution. But I think that solution, in terms of a structural or a mechanical, what would I call it, basis, was actually driven by Luis Suarez. And by the changes that Simeone has talked, really, I think Simeone spoke really eloquently about Luis Suarez. And you know, that relationship wasn't great at the end, but that wasn't great because they're two competitive men who wanted to play a part. And actually, I think it was difficult for Suarez to assimilate his diminishing role. But Simeone has spoken really eloquently about Suarez and about how Suarez imposed a change on that team and about talking about bringing the team closer to the area. And that it was Suarez that kind of, if you like, took that team over the threshold to be league champions. Now, he's not the only one by any means. And, you know, you could certainly look at Kieran Trippier. You could certainly look at Marco Llorente in that team. You could even look at Mario Hermoso, mad though it seems now, who I thought played a really big role in them winning the league. And right now, it just seems baffling that we could be talking about the same player. But I think that shift in approach made it work for João Félix as well. And in turn, of course, João Félix made it work. And it sort of, that symbiosis was found. And I just wonder if in that period, in the middle of the season where Atletico Madrid had a wobble, whether maybe that was the beginning of the end for João Félix. Because there was a slight shift back towards something else. Although not entirely, because of course Suarez kept on scoring goals. But there was a slight shift in the approach. I think for about 3 months, João Félix could make a case for saying he was the best player in Spain. But it was only 3 months. And you always get this idea of the consistency and whose fault is it. And obviously the buck stops with the coach. Why? Because he's the one who can get sacked. And because actually it's his responsibility to get the best out of these players. And we clearly know that the best of João Félix is very, very good indeed. But it's also João Félix's responsibility. It's also responsibility of the context with which he comes. If João Félix comes as a 40 million euro player, do we have the same degree of gnashing of teeth and scratching of heads as we do when he came for 126 million? That conditions everything, whether we like it or not. And so you look at this and you sort of think, somewhere else for a different price with a different manager, could it have worked? Or actually with this same manager, but a different price and a different structure, a different mindset, and a different mindset from him in terms of when you go for 125 million euros, it changes you as a person as well. And so there are all sorts of elements here. And I don't actually have the answer. And I don't have the answer in terms of culpability. And I think it's not as simple as saying it's because of Simeone.
Right.
Or as simple as saying it's because of João. Or as simple as saying, imagine if he'd gone to Real Madrid instead. Or imagine if he'd gone to, I don't know, Chelsea instead. Or imagine if he'd gone and had a season at a club like Villarreal and then taken the step up. Although that might, Benfica fans might not like me for saying that because they're a huge club. But, or imagine if he'd done it in 2 years' time instead of doing it then, at that age, that young. And this is one of the things that I find kind of difficult to fully grasp is that you look at him and think, correct me if I'm wrong, he's 23.
Yeah.
He might be 24. I think he's 23. He's young. Yeah, but this is his fourth season now. And how long do you wait? And I don't know, and I ask you two as guys who understand Atletico Madrid from a fan's point of view more than I do, but I kind of feel like when he goes, there will just be a bit of a sense of, well, it wasn't to be, and it's a bit of a pity, and it's quite sad. But it's not a tragedy, because I think we've all sort of accepted it now, that it's sort of not quite right. And yet there's also a bit of me that wonders, and can't help but wonder, imagine no one comes for him. Imagine there isn't an offer, and by the way, I think there's a good chance that there isn't an offer, you know, by the end of the market. Imagine he's forced to stay. Could that actually be the best thing that happened to everyone? Because it's at that point you say, you know what? You're screwed, mate. You might as well get on with this. And you know what? You're screwed, mate, Mr. Manager as well. You're all screwed, so make the best of this. Mm. Or does everyone give up at that point? And honestly, I don't know the answer. But it just kind of, the fact that we're not more sad about this and more upset about this is kind of what makes me sad and upset. You know, this should be a real problem that he looks like he's likely to go. That the CEO of the club is saying, actually, the best thing would be for him to leave. That feels like a really sort of flat end to me. But it's almost the fact that it's flat rather than a wailing that almost kind of makes it worse. If you see what I mean, it's almost like, oh, so what?
Yeah, I think sometimes when a player leaves La Liga to go and play in the Premier League for, say, 100 million or 50 million, whatever it costs, we as Spanish football watchers, we feel a little bit of sadness because we're like, oh, they're going to get to enjoy him now. But I think with João Félix, we're sitting there going, he's going to go there. And obviously there's a player there, but what's he going to do there? Like, so no. We're kind of, that's why there's no sadness, because
absolutely.
We're like,
the question, the way, One way of framing it, Robbie, is to, you know, that question that you and me always get asked whenever someone from Spain goes to England: is he going to succeed? That's the most basic question of all, right? Is this guy going to succeed? Let's say, for argument's sake, he goes to Chelsea or Man United or whatever. It doesn't really matter. Go. Is he going to succeed? Honestly, my answer would be, I don't know. It's possible that this guy doesn't perform. It's possible that he's brilliant, but it's possible that he doesn't perform. And now, normally, when a player goes, obviously it's someone we've seen in Spain, they've been really good, and you're enthusiastic about them. And you're not always right. Sometimes you think, oh, he's going to be amazing, and he's rubbish. But this is a guy we think, I actually sort of don't know. I don't know if he's going to be really good. I don't know if it's about him, if it's about Atletico, if it's about a whole series of things. And that comment from Simeone during the World Cup was,
I was just going to bring that up, yeah.
And I think that's a really telling comment, because it was Simeone giving him a compliment, but it was really Simeone hitting out at him, to be honest. Him saying, oh, well, it's a short competition and that suits him, as opposed to a league maybe when you want him to be committed all the time. And clearly Simeone has seen something in his attitude that he doesn't like, or in his application that he doesn't like. The problem with that is it would be too easy to say, well, Simeone's right. Because, of course, it's Simeone's responsibility for him not to have that attitude. So where does the responsibility lie? Now, ultimately, of course, it lies with the player. But it's the manager's job to mould that. And if we're going to say the manager's amazing when he gets the best out of players, then if he's not getting the best out of players, we also have to say it's partly the manager's fault. But the bottom line is, how much can a manager do if he thinks, at least, that this player isn't always performing? Now, obviously, there's another whole other debate, which is whether we look at it and go, well, actually, you know what? He's performing as well as the others, and you're not giving him opportunities, you're not giving him continuity. This is why I don't actually have an answer. I feel like, you know, we've been talking about him for 7 or 8 minutes, and I haven't actually said anything, because I actually don't know what the conclusion is.
But I also think, too, you said it there about, like, the short competition, you need to be kind of able to do it over the course of a season, and then at what point is it the manager's job to get the best out of him? And I think that's probably one of Simeone's biggest downfalls, is that he can't. There's sometimes when there's players, and I know you can't explicitly go into the dressing room and say, okay, Joe, you can take this week off, or it doesn't happen like that, but there has to be a point where you embrace the maverick a little bit, because he's going to win you a league. If you just embrace that. But Simeone can't think like that, and I think that he suffers from that, like, and everyone has to be all in all the time, whereas Joao Felix's brain as a really creative player, it just works slightly differently, and there is room for those players if you know how to handle them, and they're the players who do get you over the edge or get you over the finish line. So
that's exactly it with Joao Felix. Exactly that doubt is whether there could have been more accommodation. There is also, I mean, I genuinely think this. There is also a doubt, which is, you look at Joao Felix after 3.5 years into his fourth season at Atletico, and every now and again you can't help thinking, is he actually just not as good as we first thought? And every now and again I do think that. And then once in a while he have an amazing game, you think, wow, what a player. And this is it. You're right, Simeone, I don't think, comprehends players like that. But this is one of the reasons why, by the way, why I think Simeone loves Antoine Griezmann so much. Because I think you're talking about a genuine superstar who plays as if he was rubbish, who puts the effort in as if he has to make good his lack of talent. And it's one of the things I always liked about Luis Suarez, and I always felt with Luis Suarez, he had that one brilliant season at Atletico. You always think, imagine if he played with Simeone at 25. Imagine how much Simeone would have loved him.
Yeah, absolutely. And with Joao, he's on a run of 5 goals in 5 games now, but we've seen this
exactly,
from him
that's
before.
The other thing. You look at the stats, and actually, he's performing pretty
he's
well.
He's been pretty good. But we've seen this from him before, though. Last season, he had that run between January and March before he got injured again, where he was the best player on the team. Helped Atletico get back into the top four to stay, got them past Man United in the Champions League. The year before, as you said and as you wrote, Sid, I think he was the best player in Spain the first half of that season when Atletico won the league, and then he gets hurt again. So it's an injury or a poor period of form that just is always disrupted him. I think arguably more so than whatever Simeone's tactics are, I think just the lack of continuity, just because of, you know, bad injury luck or a run of poor form, that has conditioned, if not doomed, his Atletico stay.
Yeah,
and we'll see what happens this month. I mean, Atletico's demands, from what I've seen, are pretty high for just an initial loan move without an obligation to buy. We'll see if those demands come down over the course of the month, how intent on leaving Joao Felix is. But there's a lot more to be written here, whether it's positive or not, for Joao's time at Atletico.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right as well about that. Physical fragility has definitely been a factor in all of this. And you know, as I was writing that piece, going through his statistics, you think his statistics are actually really not that bad for a creative. I don't know if we're going to call him a forward or a creative midfielder or a number 10 or, you know, a floating eight or whatever you want to call him. And his statistics aren't that bad, but then you go through them. And obviously this is what I did, was to go through them literally game by game, and they're in clusters. And so you get you'll get a month period or a 2 month period. I mean, take this season, that opening night against Getafe, and you go, wow, look at that. And that conditions his stats for the whole season, because there's three assists in one night. Take that game out, and obviously you don't take a game out, but take that game out, and all of a sudden the stats don't look so good. But I think his stats are actually really not bad, and his contribution has, on occasions, been really high. But for example, take the league title winning season, his statistical contribution is nowhere near as high as Marco Llorente, for example. Nowhere near as high.
Sid, just to finish off, I have one last question for you that I've thought about for a while, I've thought about it before. And aside from Oviedo, the obvious answer, you're someone who strikes me as, and I've heard you talking about statistics, and you're really open to them. I get the sense that you really understand what they're for. Like, instead of this, like, say for example, expected goals just being this gospel, you're like, no, but it's just another tool to help us, you know, like, you know. And you're obviously someone who thinks deeply about the game. I don't know what title you want to give it, but like a sporting director job comes up at a club. A, would you take it? And B, what's the ideal club for you if you were ever going to become like a sporting director? No, I mean, I don't think there's anyone. Spanish, English, I don't care. Who knows more about Spanish football?
Right, I'll tell you what, you know, I mean, the fundamental thing, genuinely the fundamental thing. I mean, there's two things. One is despite those very kind words, I'm not sure I'm actually qualified for it. And number two is, I suppose that goes hand in hand with the other reason, which is I'd be so frightened of failing, and I'd be so frightened of the degree of pressure on it, which is why obviously the answer would be Oviedo, but I don't want to be responsible for probably getting it wrong. So on the premise that I'm going to get it wrong, maybe it should be Sporting Gijón. I don't know. I mean, is that the way to do this? I must admit, there have been times when I've thought about whether it'd be nice to work within the game. My view, when I thought about that, has never really been about sporting directorate. Absolutely not, because I genuinely don't think I have that capacity. I speak to friends who work in the industry, and particularly people who work with agents, not necessarily as the agents themselves, but effectively as the agent scouts, and people who see things in the game that I just don't see. I'm like, well, you know, you've seen a player and you've identified something that I don't identify in this player, or I don't have the capacity for it, and I don't have the, I don't know what it is, the feel for it, or maybe the interpretation of the stats. I think the interpretation of the stats is something you can do, but certainly not with the degree of expertise that others have. And I must admit, I thought before about doing either a coaching badge, or exactly as you're kind of implying here, doing the sporting directorate course at the Federation. As a way of, not necessarily as a way, in fact, absolutely not as a way of being a sporting director, but as a way of understanding the mechanics that go with it and understanding what's actually happening internally. But as I say, I genuinely don't think I'm sufficiently qualified for it, which is why when I thought about, you know, at some point, would it be nice to work within the game? My assumption has always been that it'd be to work within a club in a communications department rather than in the footballing side of things, because I just don't think I could presume to have the knowledge or the capacity or the ability to withstand the pressure that comes with that. And I remember saying this to Javier Gearing. Now, I know obviously being a manager is different, but I was at the Mallorca game when they survived away at Osasuna last game of last season. And he came, and I hope I'm not giving away anything over personal here, but he left the bench at the end of the game, and he went into the area where the flash zone is, and he was trying to find where the director's box was to find his wife. So, you know, so it's like, we did it. Oh, we've done it. Thank God for that, because his wife was, you know, nervous about it for him and all the rest of it. She goes to every game and stuff. And then he came back down to the flash zone to do his interviews. And he was sodden. Now, this wasn't just a bit of sweat. He was sodden. And you know, this the pressure and so on. And the first question I asked him was, why the fucking hell do you do this to yourself? Like, seriously, why would you go through this? You've made enough money in football. It was like, well, actually, my wife doesn't really want me at home. And, you know, he sort of joked about it and stuff. And I think there are people who really need this. And I think on some level, I do really need it as well. But maybe not that. I think that might be a step too far. I see quite a lot of football as it is. I quite like what I do. Admittedly, there are times, and this week is a good example of it, on a Monday morning when I've got to write a column, and this week off the back of not having watched Spanish football for 6 weeks of the World Cup and because of Christmas and stuff, on a Monday I thought, I can't do this. I can't write. I've got no idea how to put this together. This piece is, and even after I finished the piece, I thought, this piece is bloody terrible. And then you get some people weighed into below the line or on Twitter and stuff. And every now and again, and Monday was one of them, you think to yourself, you know what, they're right. This is terrible. What the hell have I written? And there is a degree of pressure. Now, again, let's get the world's smallest violin out and feel desperately sorry for the person who's paid to go and watch football and it's a lovely job and all the rest of it. But that can bring with it a degree of pressure. And I think to myself, imagine if my job actually depended on it, or imagine if my football club winning actually depended on me. And I don't think I could live with that. And I was talking to a friend of mine, I'm not going to name the club for very obvious reasons, who became involved in the communications, but not more than communications and kind of logistics part of a club in the Premier League, a big club in the Premier League. And I saw him and had a drink with him, and, you know, not from a point of view of me getting the information, but just wanting to know what it's like for him. And he said, the thing is, he said, you don't really fully appreciate it until you're inside, that everybody at that club, and there is 100, more than 100, there's the best part of 300 or 400 or 500 people working in that club. Every single person in that club, their mood, their life depends on some 25-year-old millionaire putting the bloody ball in the net. it's horrendous. And so I don't know if I could be in that position. I mean, it's bad enough as a fan being in that position. I don't know if I could be in a position within a club.
When you reduce it to those terms, like the
it's
stress
horrendous.
Level just
it's really
infinite.
Hard, man. Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
absolutely.
My God.
I wouldn't want it. No.
Oh, I could scarcely imagine. As good as I might be a football manager, I couldn't be a sporting director.
No, exactly.
I want to work
in
comms.
You sometimes think, if only it worked like that, and it kind of doesn't. And this is why, you know, there's a huge amount of admiration for those people who do the job and do the job well and actually manage to maintain a degree of kind of emotional balance. I mean, we talk a lot, don't we, about how occasionally a football manager loses the plot and has a rant, or a player loses the plot and has a rant, or even occasionally a sporting director loses the plot and have a rant. And I always think, you know, it's a miracle they don't say stupid things more often. Particularly when people like me are sticking a microphone under their nose and they've only finished 2 minutes ago and they're absolutely furious.
I have to bloody talk to the press now?
Exactly. Oh. Absolutely right. 100%.
Oh, man. So, Sid, I expect you're going to predict an Oviedo win tomorrow night.
No, I would never predict an Oviedo win. I've learned over the years to never, ever, ever, ever predict an Oviedo win. It's not just that I don't predict it. I never even believe in it. And when it happens, it's lovely. I can't see anything other than an Atletico Madrid victory, but I think that Oviedo will, given the nature of the way they've played of late, I think there's a chance they make life difficult for Atletico.
I would agree. Yeah, Atletico really struggled to get going against Antero last month. The pitch was in bad shape, sure, but Atletico looked kind of unsure as to what to do with the ball. The meetings between Cádiz and Atletico in La Liga when Tavares was coaching went Atletico's way by convincing scorelines, but I don't think we're going to see that again tomorrow. I think it could be a very tight game, and there's also added pressure on Atletico knowing that this is their shot at silverware this year. They're out of Europe.
Yeah, well,
they're not going to win La Liga.
Absolutely. Yeah, on Twitter earlier, Semra Hunter pointed out that the Atletico Madrid game at the weekend against Barcelona is on ITV, and she's presenting it. And she said, you know, come and join for this big game, don't miss it. And of course I replied to her joking, yeah, don't miss it, it's the second biggest game of Atletico Madrid's week. And actually an Atletico Madrid fan came below the line, well, not below the line, replied to the tweet and said to me, you're joking, but it's probably true.
Yeah,
because as you say, so much is invested in the Copa del Rey this year.
Yeah, they have a lot riding on it as they try to win the cup for the first time in 10 years. I think we're going to leave it there. Anything either of you would like to add before we sign off?
I hope it'll be fun, and I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, Alex Kirtland, who of course produces and presents and basically is the brains behind TSFP, sent me a WhatsApp note earlier today and said, on a scale of 1 to 100, how excited are you about this game? And I replied, 110. You know, I couldn't get tickets to start with. The tickets had all sold out. Managed to wangle away in, and then actually some tickets came onto the market. So I will be there, and I'm really looking forward to it. And the fact that it's going to be a full house, and I just hope it's a good occasion. You know, in a way, winning or losing is kind of incidental. Although I won't be thinking that tomorrow at kickoff, and I certainly won't be thinking that tomorrow in 90 minutes. But for us, I think it's more a case of kind of feeling like, you know, Oviedo can be a big club too. Or a big-ish club. I mean, obviously, not never going to be as big as Atletico, but a big-ish club.
Absolutely. I think if I write correctly, this is Oviedo's first round of 32 game in 8 years, 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, I've been saying this to friends of mine who support Oviedo and actually just moaning about it into the ever on Twitter and stuff. But one of the things that's really pissed me off about the Copa del Rey in the last 7 or 8 years, I think the last one might even have been when we went away to play David Moyes' Real Sociedad.
Mm.
And in fact, I remember David Moyes staying in the hotel, same hotel as me, in Oviedo for the return leg. And that was, I think, the last time. But as I was saying, one of the things that sort of annoyed me about the Copa del Rey in recent years isn't just that Oviedo haven't played well in it. It's that it's kind of felt like it doesn't matter to anyone. Yeah. It's like the Copa del Rey is just a thing we don't do. And I've always found that a really short-sighted view of it. If you're a second division club, yes, it's true, you're not going to win it. I mean, it's almost harder as a second division club than as a second division B club because of the way that the structure works and so on. Or rather, you know, harder than it is for say, a lower-level first division team. But you know you're going to get a big team, but you know you're not going to get the joy of the really biggest teams. This time around, it has happened, and I think everyone's really quite excited about that. And it just sort of, I've always felt, well, but this is something to enjoy, and it doesn't need to impact on your league form. In fact, it could help you. You know, let's make an event of this. And one of the frustrating things in recent years is Oviedo haven't even made an event of it. You know, going out in crappy games against teams that are not that exciting. And yeah, I think there is a real sense of, actually, you know what, this is what it's for, even if you lose. It doesn't matter if you win. Well, it does matter, but you know, it's not really about that. It's about feeling like, okay, let's have an occasion. Let's go there and enjoy it, which is supposedly the point. I mean, I know we don't enjoy football very much, and we suffer for it, and we make almost a fetishization of it not being fun and of sacrifice rather than of joy. But you are supposed to enjoy it, and it is supposed to be fun. So hopefully it will be.
It is a game at the end of the day. It's what they tell me.
So they say. I think they're lying, but so they say.
Is what I've heard. All right, gentlemen, we're going to leave it there. Sid Lowe, Robbie Dunn, thank you so much for hopping on this edition of Colchonero Chat.
Very much a pleasure.
You can find all three of us on Twitter, actually. Keep up with our work at intothecalderon.com. Our Patreon page, patreon.com/Colchonero Chat, also has bonus goodies from as little as $3 a month. Sid TSFP also has a Patreon page where you can get exclusive goodies.
It does. Most of all, the best thing is producer Al's Manir Daily world-famous paper reviews.
Absolutely. And we will be back following the Oviedo game and for the rest of the season as well. So thank you all so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Adios.